Welcome to the Mama Bear Dares podcast. I'm Tessie.
And I'm Leslie.
And you guys, the Cubs won! We are so excited. Like, normally we do a really fun and hopefully kind of inspirational intro, but you guys, we're going on like 3 hours of sleep here, so we're just gonna say this podcast is by women. For everybody.
For women. It's
for everybody.
Especially Cub fans, right?
That's right, which is really, really funny because actually on today's podcast, we're talking to Catherine Willis Pershey, who lives in Chicago but is a Cleveland Indians fan. So this feels particularly joyous for us today.
For us. Sorry, Catherine. She woke up. I mean, she's probably still celebrating, because since she lives in Chicago, but yay!
Yeah, you guys, it was so exciting. Leslie and I were Snapchatting each other all night because our husbands were the most adorable. They've been Cubs fans for their whole lives. And were they the cutest? They were the cutest.
The
whole family.
They were. Oh my gosh, it was such an exciting game. We survived somehow. It was, you know, like all, we were so very aware of the history that was being made that it just was funny. Like, we would have these Bob Saget moments once in a while.
It's so true. And I don't know if your kids were like ours, but they were just like, okay, you guys, we get it. And we kept like wanting to grab their faces and be like, but you don't get it.
You don't understand.
So anyway, so much fun. But today, Leslie, we talk, like I said, to Catherine Willis Pershey about a topic we've been exploring a bit on the podcast lately, it seems like. Marriage, right? Speaking of our brother husbands enjoying the Cubs game. So Catherine has written a book called Very Married, and a friend of the Mama Bear Dare show recommended that we read the book and reach out to the author. So we did, and that's how we got to tackle this subject with someone who's been researching and thinking about marriage for many, many years. Catherine, like many of our Mama Bear listeners, has a fascinating story about her own struggles with marriage and fidelity. And it turns out, Leslie, we just enjoyed this little piece of trivia, but it turns out that all three of us have been married to our spouses for 14 years. So clearly, she is part of our old wives club, is she not?
Right, old wives, yeah. Old wives. 14 years in, we are old wives. Yeah, that was a fun little coincidence.
It was. And I think that just kind of helped shape the conversation because the three of us come from such similar life experience. And, you know, obviously she has a unique perspective, but there was some similarities that ran through it.
Yes. And Tessie, I think my favorite part of both the book and the conversation is how we talk toward the end of the podcast about how to engage our mama bear in marriage. So, you know, we want to be better and we want to do better. And I love it when mama bear can kind of lead the way. So we're not experts by any means, but we learned a bit from Catherine and from our own research on marriage and really from our own experience. And I think, you know, as you and I were talking after the interview, I'm pretty solid in saying that we've arrived at the same conclusion, that engaging your mama bear in marriage is twofold. It means a couple of different things. First, our mama bear obviously has to nurture our own marriage. So this means doing the things like communicating with your partner. It means things like allowing just the process of growth to take place in your marriage just through learning about one another and offering each other that kindness and forgiveness and grace. And again, just through that open communication and maybe even therapy. So we need to, you know, engage our mama bears that way. It's that introspection and hard work. And again, we're not experts, but these are things that we've gleaned from our own journey. Mama Bear has to work today in her own home. So beyond the four walls of our home, there's also room for your Mama Bear to engage in larger ways as well. And Catherine writes about this in her book in a part that we really love and dive into at the end of our conversation with her. So just as marriages are different and unique, it seems that marriage as a whole, as an institution, can sometimes be a magnet for inequality. When you think about it, people who find themselves married, so who have made that choice and that commitment, it becomes one of the most crucial, most important relationships that they'll ever be a part of. It's a relationship, but it's also an institution, which can kind of complicate things. So beyond who has the right to marry who, which is a long debated struggle in and of itself, there are certain sectors of the American population who have more challenges to overcome in regards to nurturing a happy, healthy marriage. So as Catherine notes in her book, I think we also need to note on this podcast that our conversation is spoken through this social location, which means just that we are observing marriage as individuals, and that our observations aren't universal. Does that make sense? Our observations are colored by being white and educated, middle class, cisgender, heterosexual women. So I think it's important to recognize the perspective from which we take on these issues that surround marriage and these ideas.
I think that's the important part, right? That towards the end of our conversation with Catherine, like in the beginning, we talk about her personal relationship, what she saw when she studied other marriages, what she learned through her own marriage. But towards the end of our conversation, we talk more about it as an institution. And I this was probably my favorite part of the whole thing. And it was one of the shortest, just because I think it's very interesting towards the two of us, right? And I think first, we've got to recognize the impact of finances on marriage. Of course, we all have anecdotal wisdom on this topic. I mean, like it sums up probably the first 6 years of our marriage. I don't know about you, but you know, like finances are hard. When money's tight, marriage gets hard. When you don't agree with how to spend or save your money as a couple, if you both have different ideals, it's super, super hard. Or when you're working odd shifts or are in and out of the workforce, relationships get strained. If you can't afford healthy food and it's a value to you, you know, and you don't feel good, again, like all this happens and relationships become strained. None of these are really rooted in whether or not you value or are willing to work hard in your marriage. That's the tricky part, right? Like we often want to throw that on the idea that like, oh, if you just work hard, marriage is easy. Mm-hmm. No, there are simple factors that play into the health of all of our relationships. And you really, it's just terrible idea to dismiss them.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that sort of just that general state of your life also bleeds out into just the community around you. You know, think about the people that are in your lives. Are they struggling to make ends meet? Or, you know, do you have extended family and friends that have, you know, all the freedom and flexibility and resources just to help you out occasionally? And again, as old wives, like we've got kids, they complicate things, you know? We talk a little bit on the podcast about being able to afford to pay for outside help. So, you know, Catherine references that she has a person clean her house and that's an amazing gift that then allows her to concentrate on relationships. You know, we talk about being able to afford date night. Mm-hmm. So these are all supporting factors in marriage. And they all make your relationship just exponentially easier. And they're things that, you know, not everyone has access to.
Yeah. I mean, most people throughout the world do not have access to a cleaning person or, you know, the ability to go on date nights, weekly date nights. But you and I always say the first step of engaging the mama bear is to just be awake to the world. Being awake lets you know where the problem is, and then you can lend your care and your support and your righteous anger. So let's just like recap kind of what we're saying, but we haven't like outright said it. In America, African American households are the least likely to contain a married couple compared to other racial or ethnic groups. Similarly, an African American child is 3 times more likely to be born to a single parent than a white child, and on average will spend only 6 years in a two-parent family compared with 14 years for a white child and 13 years for a Hispanic child.
Yeah, I mean, those are like researched facts, right? Right, like right. We'll reference our sources in the show notes. So great point. And I think we also need to be honest about the social disruptors of marriage in America. So we go into this a bit more in the podcast, but when young Black men are being incarcerated at rates so much higher than the rest of the population, we're automatically disrupting marriages and disrupting families. And it's not because African Americans value marriage less either.
Right, right.
It's that surviving marriage, as we know, and if you've encountered a marriage in your life too, it's hard. So imagine how much harder it must be to survive a marriage that is disrupted by that financial trauma, the emotional trauma, the trauma of enduring a long absence due to, again, the legal system that currently incarcerates Black men at nearly 6 times the rate of white men. So honestly, listeners, think about your own social location. Again, if you're like us and Catherine, you're white, educated, middle class, cisgender, heterosexual, female, all of those things, it's hard to put yourself in those shoes when they're so different from your own. But we have to. It's really the only way we'll ever call our mama bear to action.
Catherine writes in the book that, I mean, this can be traced way back to slavery, right? Because slavery caused so much disruption. And we're still suffering the effects of this. Like, you can still trace so much back to slavery. It was traumatizing in every single way possible. And one of the traumas was the way it ruined healthy marriage and family relationships.
Yeah, and that cycle, unfortunately, it continues. In terms of marriage, I've read some sources that argue that the decline in marriage and then the rise in single parenthood among urban Blacks is a direct consequence of declining income of young Black men. So again, poverty. Poverty is complicating everything, including whether you get married or stay married.
Right. Sometimes we forget, and unfortunately, our government and our churches and the most well-meaning among us forget too, including the both of us, that studies show people of color and people with low incomes value marriage as an institution. They have similar standards for choosing a marriage partner and experience similar difficulties in managing their relationships. They are just like us. Just because you are lower socioeconomically or you're a person of color does not mean you're morally bankrupt. Like, let's make sure that is very clear here. Social programs meant to strengthen the institution of marriage should perhaps focus less on the sanctity of the union and more on the social issues at play. I don't even think there's a perhaps there. Like, this is what needs to happen, right? Focus less on the sanctity and more on the social issues at play. The poverty, the disruptors, the opportunity cost, and the cost of trauma on children. We know this is very, very real. And this amount of stress, it just affects the marriages.
Absolutely. I mean, we might be a little groggy after the Cubs game last night, but this still seems really clear.
Yes, absolutely.
It is complicated. It's also really complicated because there's just so much to every single individual story. But we do. We have to be awake to these things. And as we say so often on this podcast, we belong to each other. We're one another's keepers. So we've got to experience these truths and let them sink in. I mean, on some days, some of us old wives lament that one of the more pressing problems was that we got married before the age of Pinterest. But come on, guys, there is so much more to the story. So I don't know. Should we jump in with Catherine? She shares the tale really of her experience and her marriage and just the struggle and the beauty of committing to forever. And then we'll also talk more on that social impact of race and class and gender within the institution.
Yeah, let's do it.
Today's guest, as it says on the book jacket of her second book, has never slept with a mailman or kissed an ex-boyfriend, which is a good thing since she's married. What Catherine Willis Percy has done, though, is written an honest, candid book about marriage called Very Married, Field Notes on Love and Fidelity. And she's here to talk to us today about marriage, motherhood, her work, and her relationships. We are really happy and excited to welcome her, as marriage is a topic that Tessie and I are both fascinated by. And we haven't discussed it enough. I think we could discuss it over and over on many episodes. But today we'll talk about it with Catherine. So without further ado, welcome to the podcast, Catherine.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Great. Let's dive right in. Tell us how this book on marriage, which, by the way, listeners, comes recommended by a few of our favorites, Sarah Bessie and Glennon. Does Glennon need two last names anymore, or do we just know she's Glennon?
I think now that she's besties with Oprah, she can just go by Glennon.
I think you're right. I think you're right. And Glennon endorsed your book, which is amazing. So tell us how this book just came to be.
Well, it's funny. My first book was a memoir, and it was about motherhood and about my first few years in ministry. And I sort of accidentally wrote a little bit about marriage without really meaning to, but it was such a significant part of my life. I couldn't help it. And I had such a vulnerability hangover from that first book. My intention was to never be another character in a book again. And I wanted to avoid any kind of vulnerable memoir-ish writing. Well, and here we are. So I was going to say
you did a terrible job of that.
I failed miserably because the vulnerability with marriage. Yeah. So the way that it came to be is I originally had written about an experience I had, which is in the book, of going off to a conference and having a crush, realizing I had a crush on a new friend. And you know, because I'm a writer, I of course wanted to sort through that in writing, but it wasn't anything I could ever write about, you know. Because people don't admit to that kind of thing,
right?
So then I thought I would write a novel, and I started a totally fictional version in which I had this gorgeous curly hair, which I do not have. I have a terrible pixie cut. I'm like growing out a pixie cut, which I have been doing for like a year. and then I put it in a drawer because I'm not a novelist, and I just thought this isn't going to go anywhere. And then I started to think that there's so many stories of infidelity and so few stories of fidelity in the face of temptation. And so I pulled it out and I started, you know, kind of cutting away all of the fictional stuff, no more curly hair. And I rewrote it in a narrative, you know, personal essay form, and ended up publishing it. And at that point, it kind of went viral. And I had an invitation to write a whole book about marriage, which I said no to.
Did you?
I also failed at that, because again, here we are. But I'm glad I ultimately said yes. I do feel that we needed. I feel like it was a book that was needed by the culture, and so I'm glad that I finally heard the call to write it.
Right, and it just came out in September, correct?
Yes.
I like what you said about that there are stories of infidelity and growing from infidelity and all of that, but not much about fidelity, because you explored it in the book, but fidelity is actually really hard, and not necessarily in terms of like physical fidelity, but emotional fidelity, spiritual fidelity, like all of those things in a marriage is actually really, really hard. And I know no one who's talked about it but you. So where did you go to find, you know, kind of comfort, or I don't know, when I'm writing a piece that's very vulnerable, I sometimes like to call a friend who's been through something similar or read something similar to make me feel like, okay, I'm not the only one who went through this. Like, this is how I can get through it.
Well, I had from the start talked to my husband about it. I mean, as at the first opportunity, I had gone to him and said, hey, guess what? Something to talk to you about. It was, super awkward. And yet, really critical for me and for our marriage that I immediately leaned into our relationship and not into the crush. I had also talked to, you know, very close friends and my pastor. And so just in terms of like being in a place where I was ready to write about it, I had not gone through that experience alone. And one thing I've found by writing about it, I mean, that it's always an invitation. When you're vulnerable, you're always extending the invitation to those who hear your story to tell their own. Mm-hmm. And I cannot tell you how many people contacted me after that initial article went out, telling similar stories. I mean, I think part of the problem, like we lean on adultery in novels and in movies, because I mean, it's this instant plot thickener. Like, fidelity is boring. It doesn't like, oh, and they actually were faithful for the rest of their marriage. Like, mm-hmm. There's no plot there. And so I think that honestly, that's part of what throws off the balance and why we hear. I mean, I do think there are, in fact, a lot of infidelities in marriages, but I also think we hear more of those because we are such a story-centered culture and there's no plot to fidelity.
Mm-hmm. So you talk about the fact, and this is from an article that I read that you had written this summer, you talk about coming to the point in your marriage after a decade, so after 10 years in, where you and your husband were, and this is a quote, you're like, depending upon your perspective, either entering our stride or slipping into a rut. Mm-hmm. And I was honestly just talking to my therapist about this the other day. My husband and I have been married nearly 14 years, and that actually is the same amount of time that Tessie and her husband have been married, and many of our contemporaries. But that first decade of marriage, it's often about growing up together and figuring out how to live and communicate, learning to be a bit more selfless if possible, you know, things like that. But then we come to this point at about a decade in or 14 years in where we have careers and we have a home to take care of, and many of us have children, and things just get busier and a lot more complex. It does. It gets more complicated and harder, I think. So what is it, Catherine, that you and all of your research and thought about modern marriage, what do you think it is that causes so many of us to honestly stumble a little bit a decade in?
Well, you know, I think some people, that stumble comes after, you know, 10 pretty good years. For us, we had a really difficult early marriage and had done a lot of work to get to that place where you could say we were, you know, entering our stride. And so, you know, there's so much variety in relationships. I'm always reluctant to give advice, or even, you know, so many of the like typical marriage self-help books are sort of offering a tidy formula for how to have a good marriage. And mm-hmm. I mean, there are, you know, every marriage is like a snowflake, to use a super hokey, cliched metaphor. You know, no two marriages are alike because no two individuals are alike. And being present in your marriage, to like bringing your unique self and then encountering your unique spouse, there isn't an easy blanket answer for what, you know, gets people through those difficult times. I do think that having a rich understanding of what marriage is and being able to step back and look at the big picture and recognize that this, you know, it's funny, we had our 14th anniversary this summer. So we're all in the same.
We like, are. Have cheers to us. Yeah. To all of us.
I think it is a really funny time because so much of our lives are focused on our kids during this time. And recognizing that this is another stage and there's one after this, and like, no, hopefully we're at a place where, you know, you don't, early on you have an argument and you're like, oh, this means we made a terrible mistake, whatever. Like, at this point, you don't necessarily think every, you know, disastrous day trip means like you have a terrible marriage. Mm-hmm. But it's almost because you have a little bit of sense of the bigger picture, you can almost slip into that rut a little easier. So
I think you're right. I think that what we lose sight of, and this is why I think when I say fidelity is hard, I mean, because when you look at the grand picture, years like we're in right now, where everything like most days look exactly like the previous day. You know, there's not a lot of excitement. There's not a lot of like sex on the table when, you know, there's not like.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah, I guess, you know, or like trips, random day trips, you know, like this is kind of missing probably in the 14-year marriage-ish category. And so I think that's the allure of other people, right? Is that there's a part of you that misses that, but you forget that that also includes, like you said, the arguments that you're convinced you've married the wrong person, you know? So it's so strange how we are shaped by our culture, like you said, the TV and the movies who make infidelity kind of a theme or a plot thickener. But at the same time, when we really are able to step back and look at it, it's the ability to argue and to disagree with our significant other without making it feel like someone just planted a bomb that really brings such comfort too.
I think part of the tricky thing is if we only talk about fidelity in terms of whether or not one has an affair, like that's a really thin definition of fidelity and infidelity. And obviously that is a significant, enormous, blinking, glowing infidelity to have an affair with another person. But there's more, it takes more than just not like stepping out to be faithful to a marriage. And part of it is, I think, the leaning into the relationship, maintaining it as your primary source of intimacy and connection, which is not to say that we don't also need like our girlfriends or that, you know, we mm-hmm. should never have friends of, you know, of the opposite sex or anything like that, but recognizing that the marriage is the context for pretty much everything else in our lives. I mean, after, you know, I'm a person of faith. And so for me, my sort of identity as a child of God is foundational. But after that, like the next thing on the list is really my marriage, because it's the context for everything else, parenting, career, all of that. So nurturing it, I think that's part of the fidelity.
Mm. Yeah, that's great. And let's go back a little bit to kind of that. It's more than an anecdote, I guess, but the story that you do tell very honestly and with incredible vulnerability, just so our listeners are kind of up to speed. So you were at a conference and you met someone there who you liked, and you kind of felt like, yeah, you were able to identify these feelings that were a little like they were too much, right? You wanted things. I think you're right. You wanted things that you didn't want to want. And so obviously that took some introspection on your own part just to recognize what was happening to you, which I think is like a really necessary and early step when we're talking about whether or not you have an affair, you know, whether you're faithful. Like just what's happening? Where are your thoughts leading you? But talk a little bit just about that experience and then what made you decide to talk about that experience with your husband? What influences, I guess, were in working in your life that made you not act on those feelings?
Well, I mean, it was a terrifying experience. Because, you know, it took me a couple days to even realize that that was in fact what I was feeling, because it had been so long since I'd had, you know, an attraction to another person. I was kind of rusty in the crush department. and so the odd thing is, like, when I think about like the alternative path, and to be clear, I have no idea if it was even mutual. So it may have been like, even if I had wanted to have an affair, there may well not have been one, because it takes two to tango, as they say. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just think about how very many people would have been injured, what a profound undoing of my marriage and my ministry. I mean, it would have affected my children. It would have turned, I mean, ultimately, when it comes down to it, the reason I was attracted to this person was like, it was a really good guy. Like, I mean, so instead of this being someone with whom I could have like a, you know, carefully bounded platonic friendship, like he would have been like, you know, this sort of, you know, bad dude who like ripped, you know, homebreaker, you know, whatever. Like, right. Yeah, I mean, and I would have also been mm-hmm. a homebreaker. I mean, like when I think about that, like alternative reality, it is so chilling to me. Like I really, even now, even though I've written about it and talked about it, like I can still be sort of stopped cold mm-hmm. at what is at stake. And I do think I had a sense of what was at stake. I don't think that the reason I walked away was only out of sort of fear for what would happen. I also think it had like a sort of positive element of like, no, I love my husband and want to be faithful, you know, mm-hmm. but there's also, I mean, there's a lot at stake. And part of why I think I knew that is because I had been privy to some, you know, deeply traumatizing relationships, you know, that were not my own, that I saw the effects of infidelity. And so I knew I had a sense of what could happen if I chose to go down that path. And really, you know, some people have said, well, I've had that experience, but I could never actually talk to my wife or talk to my husband about that. I don't think that's necessarily like the only way to do it, that it, you know, that it, that to have that feeling and to not necessarily share. I mean, that's not like wrong for us, for me, for my husband, like that is the way we operate. I needed to talk to him about it because until I did, it felt like something that could be a wedge between us rather than something that could bring us together. Because ultimately when I went to him, it wasn't a confession of infidelity. It was a confession of temptation, but was ultimately like me saying I was faithful, and he, you know, was hurt. And it wasn't like the favorite conversation he's ever had, but he understood that what I was saying to him was that I had been faithful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting, because I think it's a testament probably to the work that you had already put into your marriage. Wouldn't you say that to be true?
Yeah, I do think so. I mean, we did a lot of couples counseling in our early years, and I do think that that had given us some tools that we didn't realize we would need in different contexts down the road.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about here and write about it in your book as well, but just this idea that, you know, marriage, secular marriage, doesn't have the same undertones that marriage within the church has, right? Like we, in the church, the marriage is talked about as a covenant, as this thing, you know, that's binding, right? And I know a lot of secular marriages, I don't know another term for that, so I don't want it to sound like I'm bad, but I know a lot of really, really successful secular marriages and a lot of really, really terrible Christian marriages, you know? I mean, so that's not necessarily an indicator of quality, I guess I should say, but there is something about the way you talk about your marriage and then the way you wrote about it that, like, there was no question to you that you would be staying with this man, at your husband at the time. You know, there was no question that you were going to do whatever it took to heal this and to not have that be a wedge between you. Why do you think that seeing marriage as kind of the sacred covenant, how do you think that works in our hearts and in our minds as a married couple?
You know, not long ago, somebody was trying to get me to say, like, I mean, ultimately to say that, like, Christian marriages are going to be happier than, you know, non-Christian marriages. And I, like, couldn't bring myself. I was, like, trying to figure out, how can I respond to this question without basically being like, no, that's totally wrong. But yeah. I mean, the statistics bear out that, like, you know, certainly divorce is just as common amongst Christians as non-Christians. Mm-hmm. And it's so easy, you know, to have this conversation without being in the context of grace, which is a deeply Christian and deeply relevant practice and word for this, because the last thing I want to do is come across as judgy toward, you know, people who have divorced. I think mm-hmm. if I were going to say what my understanding of the gospel, how that most directly informs my marriage beyond just, you know, all of the incredible, you know, language of covenant and all that. It's that, I think it's from Paul. I'm terrible about knowing like specific scriptures, so my apologies. But when he talks about how Christ's power is made perfect in our weakness. And I think that for us, I mean, recognizing that so much of our marriage has been a crucible for us to face our own individual weaknesses and our weaknesses as a couple. And that in approaching that with honesty and humility and a desire for redemption, that's how we've seen sort of the Holy Spirit work some really incredible healing power in our relationship. That's a very different promise than the sort of like, you know, shiny, happy, optimistic, Jesus makes everything better, including your marriage kind of answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you write in the book about, I think it's also Apostle Paul talking about love, right? Love is patient, love is kind, and then replacing that with someone else's word or name, mm-hmm. and then also replacing it with your name and see if you're kind of living up to those beautiful promises, you know? And I think that's interesting because like you've received this gift in this relationship, and as people of faith, you know, likely believe that it's a blessing from God and God is present in your relationship, but you also, you know, you advise your readers to committing to that, just that joyful and difficult work of cherishing another person. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that can be lost, you know, in the conversation of you may experience the blessing of marriage in a sacred context, but you are still the one who at the end of the day needs to be loved, needs to be patient, and needs to be kind in order for to fully experience like the beauty of that blessing, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, the other thing that makes me anxious when we talk about the connection between our faith and our marriages is just there's a lot of really unhelpful theology out there, and a lot of a lot of women in abusive marriages have gone to pastors through the centuries and said, you know, this is my situation, and they've been told, well, this is the cross that you have to bear, mm-hmm. by well-meaning pastors who thought that that was the way to be, you know, in a Christian marriage. And I think that's absolutely not. I mean, so I'm mindful of like all of the noise out there when we have this conversation.
Yeah. And I mean, you've spent years really, or sounds like you've always kind of been interested in this idea of marriage. And so you've spent years thinking about it. And then obviously, I don't know when you started writing the book, but it's full of research really too.
Yeah. At one point it was as if I had set out to read every single book that had ever been written about marriage. And I realized I was never going to be a marriage expert, and that the book, I didn't need to be to write this book. I mean, I'm glad I did that research, because I do feel like it allowed me to engage much more fully with, you know, theological and cultural aspects of marriage. But ultimately, I needed to write the book about marriage that only I could write, not another like well-meaning expert opinion about marriage.
But in doing so, I feel like you've kind of become an expert of sorts, at least an expert of telling your marriage story, you know, sprinkled in with a lot of great information that I certainly would not have known had I not picked up your book.
I describe myself not as a marriage expert, but a marriage geek. And that's I can take that.
That makes sense. That's good.
Well, and I think, you know, you called, like you said, each marriage is a little snowflake. And I think that's why I am often turned off by marriage experts, but am fully engulfed in the way you talk about marriage, because there are similarities in every marriage, right? Despite being little baby snowflakes, you know, and there's something way more profound to me about someone sharing their experience in really vulnerable ways than to hear an expert tell me like what my odds of divorce are.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there is a place for all of those marriage books, or at least some of those marriage books. And certainly like every snowflake marriage needs to know that like it's super important to be kind to one another. And until you learn how to practice kindness, then you're going to have problems. So there's certainly some universals, but I am of the belief that more marriages are transformed by like friends sitting around a table and, you know, sharing their story and that sort of embodied wisdom rather than advice from a book. And so what I'm trying to do in the book is offer that embodied wisdom, even though it's in book form. It's really more, I mean, I was aiming for wisdom, not advice.
Yeah, well, and I think you do that really well. And I think you're right that we're hungry for that. Like, that's how we want to experience marriage, maybe as a culture. Perhaps there is a little bit of a movement away from, you know, the Hollywood storyline and this desire for people to hear about real life marriage. I mean, obviously, Glennon's new book is hugely popular. People are reading your book. People want these really truthful accounts of in the trenches. How do we make this work? You know what? It's not all shiny and pretty. It's really hard, but I'm going to hold your hand and we're going to get through it together kind of thing.
Yeah. I will tell you, I totally flipped out when I saw that Glennon's book came out like 3 weeks before mine. I was like, nobody's going to read my book because they're all going to read her book.
No.
They're very different, even though they are, I mean, there's similarities in terms of that, you know, narrative approach, but very different books.
They are different. But I also think like, I really think people are hungry for this, for talk of marriage. I mean, we've recorded two podcasts, I think, on marriage now. And it's something we kind of circle back to as being, like you say, I mean, it's one of the most important relationships, if not the most, in most people's lives.
Well, I think the tricky thing is that we've been so embroiled in culture wars about marriage, and there are actually like a ton of very conservative Christian resources for marriage, that most of which didn't really speak to me theologically or culturally. I'm not a fundamentalist, and I'm glad that there are excellent resources for very conservative Christians, but that was the bulk of the sort of practical stuff. Or on the other hand, you have like secular sort of psychologist written books about marriage. And so it is kind of a funny book in that it is, you know, deeply rooted in my faith and in my experience as a pastor. But I was really trying to transcend the culture wars aspect and write something that could speak to people, you know, regardless of how they feel about, you know, egalitarian or complementarian marriage, or even, you know, marriage equality, which, you know, there's going to be some people who will be, basically, I feel like I'm like guaranteed to offend everyone at some point in the book. But yeah, hopefully people can handle that.
I think so. I think we're all, I mean, I'm sure we've offended people on the podcast and I apologize for that, but I'm sorry.
I'm going to start singing Beyonce if you're not careful.
I know. I was going to say, well, like that leads me when you were talking about, you know, we're hungry for this talk of marriage, and how I just had to laugh that, you know, when Glennon came out with her book on marriage 3 weeks before you, Beyonce came out like months before the both of you, which, you know, and her visual album Lemonade was all about marriage. And I remember watching it for the first time and I was bawling. It's not only visually beautiful and stunning, but you can hear, even if you haven't seen the visual album, you can hear just her heartbreak, her pain, all of this. And she goes through literally every emotion that marriages have gone through, whether there's been infidelity or not. And you wrote about Beyonce. Why did her experience resonate with you? Like, what struck you about it?
Well, I mean, it's amazing, and I'm still listening to it. Like, I do also listen to Hamilton, but after some Hamilton, then I go back to Beyonce.
See, this is why we would be friends for sure. Like, we've covered everything, basically, all the important things.
Yeah, I mean, that Beyonce album came out just as I mean, it might have been like a week before my manuscript was due, and I was like, I cannot write a book that comes out in 2016 that does not engage Beyonce and her incredible album about marriage. And so I ended up writing about it in an article for the Chicago Tribune, but then also finding a way to work it into one of the chapters. And I think what is so powerful about that is that it moves through, powerfully moves through different stages without jumping to redemption. I mean, it's like a harrowing song cycle about facing uncomfortable truths and rebuilding the trust that's been broken and reestablishing healthy boundaries. I mean, that the one song where she is like expressing her anger, like that's the one that undoes me, in part because see like, you know, that's what I could have faced had I not walked the path I did. Mm-hmm. But it's just powerful to see that level of fury. And so I think, she works through it. It keeps moving ahead. It doesn't jump to forgiveness, but it takes the long road to forgiveness, and there is reconciliation at the end, but it's not a cheap grace. It's an amazing album.
One of my favorite parts was, you know, you've got this anger and this fury, and she's blown everything up. She set everything on fire, right? Which we've all felt that in a marriage. You're like, blow this thing up, because we need to start from scratch. And they get to that point, and then there's the song that is, it's mostly her vocals, very little music with it, you know, and you're reminded of how when you get back, when you blow it all up, when you hit rock bottom within your marriage, then what comes next is like everybody's unmasked. And there we are, we're showing up with none of the frills or the whistles. And we're just looking at each other, just like totally broken and vulnerable and naked. And then there's the healing process, but it's ugly, you know? And I love what you said there, that it's a slow walk to grace, right? It's a slow walk to redemption. And she takes her time. Like, there is no rushing it. And anytime you've been through that in a marriage, that's exactly what it feels like.
I want to pivot just a little bit, Catherine, before our time ends, because you write in the book a lot or a little bit about marriage and justice. And so we're all about using our mama bear for good, right? Like, we have this fierce power inside of us, and we want to spread it out, and we want to use it in the world to make the world a better place. So will you just talk a little bit about what you have learned about marriage and about justice in the United States at this particular moment, and how the two kind of fuse together, what ways they do, what ways they don't? And then maybe just tell us a little bit about how you could see, you know, the average woman using her mama bear for good with marriage in mind, in the theme of marriage.
Well, I felt like it was important to name the ways that white privilege and socioeconomic privilege had contributed to the health of my marriage. That is not something we often encounter in typical Christian marriage books, but sociologists of marriage have definitely been naming that there is an incredible disparity between, marriage rates and divorce rates, between white people's white marriages are significantly less likely to end in divorce than marriages between African American couples. And I think we really need to acknowledge and wake up to the history that has the history of oppression that has contributed to that. And that's, again, something that you don't usually encounter in marriage books. But I wanted to tease out what nuance is there, and not go along with that old statistic of 50% of marriages end in divorce. while in fact, far less than 50% of white marriages end in divorce, and far more than 50% of Black marriages end in divorce. And there's, I mean, slavery separated families, decimated the family. And then the, you know, decades and decades of oppression since and racism since have compounded that effect. And so acknowledging the ways that white privilege and socioeconomic privilege contribute to the health of marriage, and then the ways that racial and socioeconomic disadvantage contribute is like a basic thing we need to do, and not try to throw out judgment toward Black families when without understanding the context that is has contributed to that. That reality. And so I hope that there will be more ministries and more, what I worry about is that we'll just have more ministries to try to, you know, strengthen families without doing the work to dismantle racism. Because back in the Bush administration, there was the Healthy Marriage Initiative, and they threw like a ton of money at trying to strengthen families. But they didn't do any anti-racism work. They didn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was no more economic opportunity. Not to throw out a word that like totally terrifies people, but there was no reparations. Mm-hmm. And so there's like almost like calcified injustice that is contributing to a crisis. And so being aware of that, I don't know what we can do with our Mama Bear Power about it. I mean, that is the sort of, from my vantage point, a sort of unanswerable question, but awareness seems absolutely critical at this point.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I mean, we always say when we've covered rape culture, we've covered racism, we've covered all of that. And the number one step to engaging your mama bear is awareness. This might be the first time some of our listeners have even put that together, right? But I think there are productive ways you can get involved. I mean, one of the other things that's disrupting marriages is prison, right? And so you look at like amazing books like The New Jim Crow and things like this, where you're recognizing there's an injustice in our justice system. And so those account for so many divorces and separations as well. So there are ways that we can become engaged and can be, you know, serve our local levels to make sure that that's not happening in our community, but it's going to take work. And like you said, the first step is awareness. You've got to understand that it's not just surface level. These people are divorcing because of something, but it's a history of systemic issues that have disrupted this ability to have the same privileges as white people. And one of those is in staying married.
Mm-hmm. We have the resources to seek, you know, we spend a lot of money on marriage counseling, and we currently mm-hmm. spend a lot of money on getting our house cleaned. And that is like every bit as valuable as the marriage counseling was.
Yes. So,
that's privilege.
Absolutely.
We're just somehow like, to think that we are superior is not even remotely true. And yet I think that's what the culture, that's the message, that's the implicit message that the culture sends, and it needs to be dismantled.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think really even our listeners, if you get to go on date night once a week or once a month, I mean, that is an exercise of privilege. You know, you can hire a babysitter and you can, I mean, go out for dinner or ice cream or whatever it is. And yeah, those are ways we're exercising our kind of unique position. And so I love that part of your book. I'm so glad that you included it. And I'm glad we had a little bit of time to talk about it here too.
I'm glad you brought it up. A lot of people don't when they want to talk about the book. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that that's something that's of interest and importance to your listeners.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. So Catherine, after listening to our conversation here, our listeners are definitely going to want to read this book of yours. Came out in September. but tell them where they can get a copy of your book, and then also tell them where they can find you on social media and learn more about you and follow along on your journey.
Sure. Well, the book should be available at bookstores. I mean, it may have to be a special order because it's a small press. Herald Press is a wonderful publishing house affiliated with the Mennonite Church, so which is great, but it probably might not be at Barnes & Noble if you go to your local big box bookstore. But it's available on Amazon. You can order it directly from the Menno Media Herald Press site. And if you look me up on my website, that's katherinewillispershey.com. It has links to places where you can find the book. And then on Twitter, I'm at KW Pershey. Same with Facebook and Instagram. You can find me at KW Pershey.
Good. And I know you have a newsletter. I subscribe to your newsletter, Katherine. I don't know if you knew that or not.
I did. I saw that. You know, I don't send out very many just because I know how much email I get. And so I'm really cautious about only sending it out probably 4 times a year. So if you do want to stay connected, I promise I really won't inundate you.
Thank you so much for just taking the time to talk to us. We think you're doing great work and brave work. And we applaud you and thank you for being here.
Well, yeah. Thank you for having me. And I think you're doing great work too. So I'm glad it worked out for us to talk.
Yeah.
Thank you. Same.
Mama Bears, today we dare you to first pinpoint your social location. You just listened to a conversation between 3 white, educated, middle-class, cisgender, heterosexual women. 2 of us grew up with 2 parents, 1 in a single-parent household. We've all been married for 14 years. Do you come from a similar perspective, or do you come to the subject of marriage and fidelity and living in America from totally different places? Today we ask you to just identify the ways in which your lenses are shaded. In doing so, you'll be able to better understand your own experience in your own marriage and the life and union of others. Once you identify the influences that help shape your experience in this world, do your best to allow them to play out in healthy, productive, and positive ways. Got a little extra middle class in you? Well, then share the wealth. Have a little extra education? Share your knowledge. Have the ease and the comfort of being in the majority? Then use that to quiet someone else's discomfort. Engage your own marriage with your fierce and tender mama bear spirit and give it all you've got within the walls of your apartment or your condo or your McMansion. Grow from where you are and then look beyond those 4 walls and think about the system in which we all live. We're all in this together, friends. We've got to do what we can to lift each other up. Honestly, life can only be better that way.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so good. You guys, thank you so much for coming along with us today. Please follow us on our social media, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We don't just do that because like we want likes or something. We really do that because when we get to discuss things on those social media outlets, it feels like a richer conversation, right? It feels like we're in a room with you. We're in the room where it happens, you guys. So make sure you guys comment on that, especially what makes your marriage hard? What healing measures have you taken? Do you have a good support network that helps lift you up? Have you ever considered some of the things that we talked about on the podcast today? We want to know. Make sure you leave a comment for us to engage in the conversation. And also, you guys, Katherine was recommended to us from a friend of the show. So make sure if you have a friend who you think would be dynamic and awesome and inspirational, then email us at mamabeardares@gmail.com. And we would love to get in touch with them.
Yeah. And they don't have to have written a book.
No. Or they don't have to do anything other than you just are like, I love having conversations with them.
Exactly.
You will too.
Exactly.
That's what we want. Okay. So you guys, let's do this. Let's go vote. God help us, and then come back Wednesday for a little post-election shake the dust off and survival guide.
That's right. Let's do this, America. See you on Wednesday.
America.